Chapter 54. The President went on national television that same evening to reveal his meeting and accord with President Antonov of the Soviet Union. In his 23-minute address, he briefly outlined his programs to aid the communist countries. He also stated his intention to abolish the barriers and restrictions on purchases of American high technology by the Russians. Never once was Congress mentioned. He spoke of the Eastern Bloc trade agreements as though they were already budgeted and set in motion. He closed by promising that his next task would be to throw his energies behind a war to reduce the national crime rate. The ensuing uproar in government circles swept all other news before it. Curtis Mayo and other network commentators broadcast scathing attacks on the president for overstepping the limits of his authority. Specters of an imperial presidency were raised. Congressional leaders who had remained in Washington during the recess launched a telephone campaign encouraging their fellow lawmakers who were vacationing or campaigning in their home states to return to the Capitol to meet an emergency session. House and Senate members, acting without the counsel of their majority leaders, Moran and Larimer, who could not be reached, solidly closed ranks against the president in a bipartisan flood. Dan Fawcett burst into the Oval Office the next morning, anguish written on his face. "Good God, Mr. President, you can't do this." The president looked up calmly. "You're referring to my talk last night?" "Yes, sir, I am," Fawcett said emotionally. "You as good as went on record as saying you were proceeding with your aid programs without congressional approval."
"Is that what it sounded like?"
"It did."
"Good," said the president, thumping his hand on the desk, "because that's exactly what I intend to do."
Fawcett was astonished. "Not under the Constitution. Executive privilege does not extend that far."
"God damn it, don't try and tell me how to run the presidency," the president shouted, suddenly furious. "I'm through begging and compromising with those conceited hypocrites on the Hill. The only way I'm going to get anything done, by God, is to put on the gloves and start swinging."
"You're setting out on a dangerous course. They'll band together to freeze out every issue you put before them."
"No, they won't," the president shouted, rising to his feet and coming around the desk to face Fawcett. "Congress will not have a chance to upset my plans."
Fawcett could only look at him in shock and horror. "You can't stop them. They're gathering now, flying in from every state to hold an emergency session to block you."
"If they think that," the president said in a morbid voice Fawcett scarcely recognized, "they're in for a big surprise."
The early morning traffic was spreading thin when three military convoys flowed into the city from different directions. One Army Specialist Counter-Terrorist Detachment from Fort Belvoir moved north along Anacostia Freeway, while another from Fort Meade came down the Baltimore and Washington Parkway to the south. At the same moment, a critical operation force attached to the Marine Corps base at Quantico advanced over the Rochambeau Bridge from the west. As the long lines of 5-ton personnel carriers converged on the Federal Center, a flight of tilt-rotored assault transports settled onto the grass of the mall in front of the Capitol reflecting pool and disgorged their cargo of crack Marine field troops from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. The 2,000-man task force was made up of United Emergency Response Teams that were on 24-hour alert. As they deployed around the federal buildings, they quickly cleared everyone out of the Capitol chambers, the House and Senate offices. Then they took up their positions and sealed off all entrances. At first, the bewildered lawmakers and their aides thought it was a building evacuation due to a terrorist bomb threat. The only other explanation was an unannounced military exercise. When they learned the entire seat of American government was shut down by order of the president, they stood shocked and outraged, conferring in heated indignation in small groups on the grounds east of the Capitol building. Lyndon Johnson had once threatened to lock out Congress, but no one could believe it was actually happening. Arguments and demands went unheard by the purposeful-looking men dressed in field camouflage and holding M-20 automatic rifles and riot guns. One senator, nationally recognized for his liberal stands, tried to break through the cordon and was dragged back to the street by two grim-faced Marines. The troops did not surround or close the executive departments or independent agencies. For most of the federal offices, it was business as usual. The streets were kept open and traffic directed in an efficient manner local citizens found downright enjoyable.
The press and television media poured onto the Capitol grounds. The grass was nearly buried under a blanket of cables and electronic equipment. Interviews before cameras became so hectic and crowded that senators and congressmen had to stand in line to voice their objections to the president's unprecedented action. Surprisingly, reaction from most Americans across the country was one of amusement rather than distaste. They sat in front of their television screens and viewed the event as if it were a circus. The consensus was that the president was throwing a temporary scare into Congress and would order the troops removed in a day or two. At the State Department, Oates huddled with Emmett, Brogan, and Mercier. The atmosphere was heavy with a sense of indecision and suspense. "The president's a damned fool if he thinks he's more important than the constitutional government," said Oates. Emmett stared steadily at Mercier. "I can't see why you didn't suspect what was going on." "He shut me out completely," said Mercier, his expression sheepish. "He never offered the slightest clue of what was on his mind." "Surely Jesse Simmons and General Metcalf weren't a party to it," Oates wondered aloud. Brogan shook his head. "My Pentagon sources say Jesse Simmons flatly refused." "Why didn't he warn us?" asked Emmett. After Simmons told the president in no uncertain terms that he was off base, the roof fell in. A military security guard detail escorted him home, where he was placed under house arrest. "Jesus," muttered Oates in exasperation, "it gets worse by the minute." "What about General Metcalf?" asked Mercier. "I'm sure he voiced his objections," Brogan answered. "But Clayton Metcalf is a spit-and-polish soldier who's duty-bound to carry out the orders of his commander-in-chief. He and the president are old, close friends. Metcalf undoubtedly feels his loyalty is to the man who appointed him to be chief of staff and not Congress." Oates's fingers swept an imaginary dust speck off the desktop. "The president disappears for 10 days and after his return falls off the deep end." "Huckleberry Finn," Brogan said slowly. "Judging from the president's behavioral patterns over the past 24 hours, Mercier said thoughtfully, "the evidence looks pretty conclusive." "Has Dr. Lugovoy surfaced yet?" Oates asked. Emmett shook his head. "He's still missing." "We've obtained reports from our people inside Russia on the doctor," Brogan elucidated. "His specialty for the last 15 years has been mind transfer. Soviet intelligence ministries have provided enormous funding for the research. Hundreds of Jews and other dissidents who vanished inside KGB-operated mental institutions were his guinea pigs. And he claims to have made a breakthrough in thought interpretation and control." "Do we have such a project in progress?" Oates inquired. Brogan nodded. "Ours is codenamed Fathom, which is working along the same lines." Oates held his head in his hands for a moment, then turned to Emmett. "You still haven't a lead on Vince Margolin, Larimer, and Moran?" Emmett looked embarrassed. "I regret to say their whereabouts is still unknown." "Do you think Lugovoy has performed the mind transfer experiment on them, too?" "I don't believe so," Emmett answered. "If I were in the Russian shoes, I'd keep them in reserve in the event the president doesn't respond to instructions as programmed." "His mind could slip out of their grasp and react unpredictably," Brogan added. "Fooling around with the brain is not an exact science. There's no way of telling what he'll do next." "Congress isn't waiting to find out," said Mercier. "They're out hustling for a place to convene so they can start impeachment proceedings." "The president knows that, and he isn't stupid," Oates responded. "Every time the House and Senate members gather for a session, he'll send in troops to break it up. With the armed forces behind him, it's a no-win situation." "Considering the president is literally being told what to do by an unfriendly foreign power, Metcalf and the other joint chiefs can't continue giving him their support," said Mercier. "Metcalf refuses to act until we produce absolute proof of mind control," Emmett added. "But I suspect he's only waiting for a ripe excuse to throw his lot in with Congress." Brogan looked concerned. "Let's hope he doesn't make his move too late." "So the situation boils down to the four of us devising a way to neutralize the president," Oates mused. "Have you driven past the White House today?" Mercier asked. Oates shook his head. "No, why?" "Looks like an armed camp. The military is crawling over every inch of the grounds. Word has it the president can't be reached by anybody. I doubt even you, Mr. Secretary, could walk past the front door." Brogan thought a moment. "Dan Fawcett is still on the inside." "I talked to him over the phone," Mercier said. He presented his opposition to the president's actions a bit too strongly. I gather he's now persona non grata in the Oval Office. We need someone who has the president's trust. Oscar Lucas, Emmett said. Good thinking, Oates snapped, looking up. As head of the Secret Service, he's got the run of the place. Someone will have to brief Dan and Oscar face to face, Emmett advised.
I'll handle it, Rogan volunteered.
You have a plan? Asked Oates.
Not off the top of my head, but my people will come up with something.
Better be good, said Emmett seriously, if we're to avoid the worst fear of our founding fathers.
And what was that? Asked Oates.
The unthinkable, replied Emmett. A dictator in the White House.